good evening. We're going to get started. Thank you for being here. We've got another good group, and we've got volunteers already. Go get extra chairs if we need to in the next few minutes. So thank you very much for coming out. We are in 1 Kings chapter 5, and we're going through the Old Testament survey. It'd be nice to teach through these verse by verse. I keep getting dragged into that. But we're really just trying to skim through the Old Testament, kind of put some things in sequence. And we're probably going to make a shift tonight, if I was planning to do it last week, from David and Solomon into the divided kingdom, where we got northern Israel and the southern Judah, and kind of do an overview of that real quick, just kind of put some piece together and then come back and kind of walk through it scripturally a little bit. We are on we're going to be right around page 112 tonight in the book, and we'll look at that here, I think, in a little bit. We got started with Solomon last week, and he was just getting ready to build the temple. And again, we could spend several weeks just talking about the temple, but I just want to breeze through the sequence of events through Solomon's reign. And then when we get through Solomon and we introduce Jeroboam and Rehoboam, then we'll maybe stop and look at the book real quick and look at some things there. So, hey, let's bow our heads. I'll pray and we'll get started. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus, and we do thank you again for the chance to be here. We thank you for this building. We thank you for this country. We thank you for the chance to live at this time in history. We do ask that your word would be made real to us as we study it, as we look into it, that your spirit would move through us and speak to us, that we'd be empowered and equipped to become the people you've called us to be at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, we're in 1 Kings chapter 5, and what we've done last week, King David grew old. He died, handed the kingdom over to Solomon, had a little bit of a revolt with Adonijah, the oldest son. Several people were put to death, some directed by David. David told Solomon to kill them. Some Solomon had to put to death as the revolt continued. But his kingdom has been firmly established. We looked last week at some of the daily provisions that they had and just kind of basically how he had to go about establishing his kingdom. Now, in chapter 5, we just introduced this last week too, but it says, when Hiram, king of Tyre, heard that Solomon had been anointed king to succeed his father David, he sent envoys to Solomon. And so if we had a map, and I just drew this on the board, I don't want to erase it quite yet. But yeah, the Phoenician kingdom's up north, just north of Israel on the seacoast. And Hiram, who helped David during his reign, has sent envoys or ambassadors down to say, well, you know, I'm glad your throne has been established. Well, then the next part right here, Solomon says something to him in verse 3. He says, you know that because of the wars waged by my father David from all sides, he could not build the temple. David did establish peace, but he wasn't allowed to build the temple under God's direction. Nathan came and told him, the prophet told him, no, you're not the one, but a son after you will do it, both historically and as a shadow of the son that's yet to come to build the temple in the kingdom. Well, Hiram in verse 7 responds to Solomon. He was greatly pleased. He says, praise be the Lord today, for he has given David a wise son to rule over a great nation. And he sent this word to him, that he had helped provide the cedar logs and the pine logs to build whatever he needed built. And so in verse 10 it says, Hiram kept Solomon supplied with all the cedar and pine logs he's going to need. So in the next 20 years, he's going to take and build the palace, take him 7 years to build the palace, and the full 20 years, or the rest of the 20 years, to build his palace, the temple in 7 years, the palace in up to 20. It lists there what he sent over to him. Solomon sent Hiram 125,000 bushels of wheat each year, 115,000 gallons of olive oil each year as a payment. What we're going to see right here is these building projects within 20 years, as Solomon wraps these major building projects up, it looks like he's in debt. It looks like Solomon is taking the kingdom to a level of financial debt, and he goes in search of gold. Everybody wishes they could do that. Well, we need more money, just go look for gold. In Solomon's case, it's going to work. He's going to go off and build ships and go search for gold and bring back shiploads of gold, and that's really going to help his kingdom. But we all would know that would be nice even in our economy today. Verse 13, it says Solomon's conscripted laborers, and he's going to have 30,000 men that it talks about in here, and they're going to spend, if it says right here in verse 14, he sent them off to Lebanon, that's Phoenicia up in the north, in shifts of 10,000 a month, so that they spent 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Remember this name, Adoniram, was in charge of the forced labor. He's eventually going to be killed, stoned to death by the revolt after Solomon's death. They've had enough of this individual. So you've got these people alternating working. So you've got 30,000 working, 10,000 a month are at work, 20,000 are at home, and they just continue to shift that way to continue to saw down the logs along with the Phoenicians and bring it down into Jerusalem. Solomon builds the temple in chapter 6. Now, this is what he got written on the board. It says, in the 480th year after Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. Just a note in passing, when you read stuff like this in the Old Testament, this is not the makings of a legend, you see. This is a document. When it gives you the month, the year, and it's dated, it's part of that built-in proof. People become critical. They say, well, these are just stories that were told. They built up around campfires over the years. Absolutely not. When they're giving the month and the year and the details, there was a scribe writing this down, looking at the calendar as he was writing it. So, I mean, it's throughout the Bible, especially in Genesis. Now, if you put that together, in our earlier teaching, and this is the traditional date of the Exodus, right around 1445, 1446, if you subtract 480 years from that, you're ending up in 965, which is the date of this right here. And this figures in. This would be the it's a typical date. David is right around 1000 BC. Solomon's now reigning right here. And then right around the year 965 is when the temple was begun. And you can build off of this year and continue to date the reigns of the kings of Israel and Judah. And it just clicks off very, very smoothly. There is another date for the Exodus that puts it up around 1250 BC, makes Ramses the Pharaoh. And, of course, that messes this up, but they think that it works better. Some more liberal people would believe it that way. But 1445 matches up very well with, and we mentioned earlier, Hatshepsut would have been the princess who was the Pharaoh's daughter who takes him out of the Nile River. The kings were Thutmose the first, Thutmose the second, Thutmose the third. And we've mentioned that too. I'll just say it again. Thutmose, and that would have made Thutmose, Moses, in a sense, stepfather or the Pharaoh that was over the land. And when Moses would have left, watch this, remove the name of the God from his name, and what do you end up with? Moses. So that fits perfectly with 1445. Just again, a very good historical reference that is in there that a lot of people don't put together. Just want to be critical. Okay, but anyway, he begins building this and talks about the temple. In verse 7 it says, in building the temple, only blocks dressed at the quarry were used, and no hammer, chisel, or any other iron tool was heard at the temple site where it was being built. We left off last week talking about Mount Moriah. If we have the city of Jerusalem, let's go back in your books to page, I need to just keep moving here. But on page 109, you've got right there, you've got a little map at the bottom of page 109. The little circle, little footprint-like, that's the city of David, or the Jebusite city David conquered. Just to the north of that, that little circle is about 10 acres. Just to the north of that, where it says Mount Moriah, we're on page 109 in the textbook. Mount Moriah, that is going to be, that's Araunah's threshing floor, the Jebusite Araunah, who David purchases that from him when the angels stop the destruction of the Israelites. David purchases that, and that is where Solomon is going to build the temple. That's about a 32-acre area that was added to Jerusalem during Solomon's reign. And he's going to have to build walls around that and fortify that also. But on that Mount Moriah, here's the mount right here. You're looking at the mountain. Solomon has already then been building these blocks up around here like this and filling them in. And he's building like a sandbox, if you would, around the mountain, and just continues to add as he fills it in and keeps adding up the blocks, filling it in until finally it's all built up around it. And the only thing that's exposed is the top of the mountain, or it's not even a mountain, it's a mound, the top bedrock, and right here is where the temple is going to be built, on the bedrock there that's remaining. And this other surface right here becomes known as the Temple Mount. And that is where today the Dome of the Rock is standing. Dome of the rock that the dome is over, is that exposed bedrock right where the Ark of the Covenant would have sat, right where the Temple of Jerusalem or Israelites would have sat. And this is what they're talking about now, is Solomon's building on Mount Moriah, just north of the city that David conquered, and it's going to be part of the city. But as they're bringing in these stones for the temple, it says they're chiseling them at the quarry. And these stones weren't just rocks that were just, you know, piled up. They were chiseled out perfect. These stones here in the corners would have been very, very large. I mean, thousands of tons, huge stones. It would have been cut out perfectly square, rolled in, set in place, and the temple would have been built off of that. And so all these, the blueprints that David talks about in 1 Chronicles that David had prepared and handed to Solomon, David got all the material ready, had everything lined up, had the blueprints all drawn up. they would have detailed each stone on how it had to be built, and it would have been brought in and set in place, as it says right there. They didn't use hammers on the temple site because everything was already cut out at the quarry. It goes on in verse 12 of chapter 6 of 1 Kings. It says, as for this temple, the word of the Lord came to Solomon and says, as for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations, keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites. So throughout this talk, throughout this building process, there's going to be several times where God is going to come and reiterate, this is good, this is my place, but you're going to have to do more than just build the temple, you're going to have to live according to my standards. It's what's eventually going to get the Israelites in trouble towards the end of 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings. Now, interestingly, if you look in verse 15, he lined its interior walls with cedar boards, paneling them from the floor of the temple to the ceiling, and covered the floor of the temple with planks of pine. So when you walk into this building, this temple that they were building, inside was all lined with wood. It's going to say in one of these verses, there wasn't any stone that could be seen. It was all paneled wood with cedar on the walls, pine on the floor. Now, eventually, we're going to get to this. They're going to carve in the wood, carve palm trees, pomegranates, open flowers, a cherubim are going to be carved, and then it's going to be overlaid with gold. So it's going to be it's not just a block building. It's a block building covered with wooden panels, carved in the wooden panels, and then overlaid that with gold. It continues to read right here. It talks about, let's go to verse, let's look in verse 18. The inside of the temple was cedar, covered with gourds and open flowers. Everything was cedar. No stone would be seen on the inside. He prepared the inner sanctuary. Now, let's do this real quickly. Here's that temple now. This is the temple building. I know it's just a rectangle, but it's a temple building. It's a large temple mount that it's sitting on. In the back here is going to be, and again, it should be square, this is going to be known as the Holy of Holies. And this is the holy place out here. In the holy place, in the tabernacle, there was a lampstand on this side, a table over here with showbread or the bread of the presence there, and then a small incense altar right here. They'd burn incense on it. It wasn't much bigger than like something like this. And then back in here is where the Ark of the Covenant was going to be. Now, in Solomon's temple, there's going to be several lampstands that are built, several tables of bread here, just built one altar, and then one of the Ark of the Covenant is going to be moved in here in just a little bit. But the dimensions are given here of this holy place. Let's try to make it square this time. There it is. It's still not square. It says right here in verse 19, he prepared the inner sanctuary, that's the most holy place, within the temple to set the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord there. The inner sanctuary is 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 20 cubits high. So that's 30 feet by 30 feet by 30 feet. Gives you a perspective of how big it was. What is this? This is, 8 feet high right here. So this is 8 feet. It's going to be, three times as high as this room. About this. And it's a square. So it's 30 by 30 by 30. As we read this now, it goes on. It says, he overlaid the inside with pure gold and also overlaid the altar of cedar. Solomon covered the inside of the temple with pure gold and he extended the gold chains across the front. So he overlaid the whole interior with gold. So that whole interior here, this is all blocks on the outside, built up, real nice blocks, paneled with wood, overlaid with gold. Everything's gold. You walk in, it's all gold. Now, on Nick's set right here, we're going to talk about the cherubim in verse 23. In the inner sanctuary, he made a pair of cherubim out of olive wood. And this just gives you an image of this. You're just fortunate that I am an artist up here. Now you're looking at it. Now you're a priest walking in. Here's a priest right here walking into this 30 feet by 30 feet. It's a 30-foot cube. Now, he's going to build these cherubim out of olive wood. Each 10 cubits high, or 15 feet high. So right here, there's going to be a cherubim. Now again, here we go. This is a cherubim. It's going to have wings, it says, over here on this side. Here's the head of the cherubim. Here's the wings over on this side. It looks like a cross, kind of, doesn't it? It wasn't supposed to look like a cross, but very nice. And here's the other one. That's kind of, oh man, we should put like a round head on them. There we go. That looks better. Like this. But they're 15 feet high, and that's what it says, 10 cubits. Now watch this. One wing of the first cherub was 5 cubits long, one wing, that's 7.5 feet. And the other wing was 5 cubits, or 7.5 feet, 10 cubits from wingtip to wingtip. So from this wingtip, this was 7.5, as if you care all these details. I just think it's cool. 7.5. But from wingtip to wingtip, it was 15 feet or 10 cubits. So there's two of them. It's going to say that this wing was touching the wall. The wings were touching here, and this wing was touching here, and they're 15 feet high. So halfway up through the room are these cherubim. So that's, again, what is on the inside. It tells you that right there. And they're made out of olive wood covered with gold. If you look in verse 27, about halfway through verse 27, the wing of one cherub touched one wall while the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the room. He overlaid the cherubim with gold. Verse 29, on the walls around the temple in both the inner and outer rooms, he carved cherubim, palm trees, open flowers. He also covered the floors of both the inner and outer rooms of the temple with gold. So when you talk about the flowers, the cherubim, the open flower or the palm trees, this is going to look like a garden. And if you think about it's not like a direct connection, although I think you're free to kind of go there, it resembles the Garden of Eden. The cherubim were there. Remember the cherubim guarding the way to the tree of life? There were trees there. It was a beautiful place. It was the presence of God was there. And when they sinned, they are forced to be removed from it. So it's almost like they're recreating the presence of God here in this garden-like covered with gold. Just something to kind of keep in mind. Verse 31, it says, for the entrance of the inner sanctuary, he made doors. So they make these out of olive wood. They're going to be covered with gold also. The last verse there in chapter 6, it says, verse 38, again, the details. In the 11th year, in the month of Bul, B-U-L, the 8th month, the temple was finished in all its details according to its specifications, meaning according to the blueprints that David had received by the Spirit of God, recorded in First Chronicles. He had spent 7 years building this tabernacle. So it was finished in his 11th, temple in his 11th year. Now, the next thing he's just going to mention here, then we're going to go back to the temple in just a moment. It took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. The temple, 90, 40, 35, those are the dimensions of it. That's length, width, and height. Length, width, and height. It was 90 feet long, 40 feet wide, 35 feet high. 150, 75, and I think it's 45. This is how big his temple or his palace was. So the temple was 90 feet long. Solomon's palace itself was 150 feet long. I think it's 75 compared to 40, so it's a lot wider. And now he's going to talk about the palace. The palace is going to take longer to build. It's going to be, it's not just going to be a big building necessarily. It's going to be more of a complex. It's going to be a big layout. And this is just, for example, we're going to get to this in just a moment. There's going to be this thing called the throne room, which is going to be where Solomon's throne is going to be set. There's going to be rooms around this, entrances into this throne room, so we're going to have some rooms around this. There's going to be colonnades or pillars all along holding everything up. And then his palace is going to be back here. Another part of this palace is going to be his actual living quarters with rooms and his bedchambers and all of his private area over here. So he'd come out into here, sit on his throne, hear cases from the public, and this is, again, the ideal of the palace. Here's some details about that palace. It says in verse 2, he built the palace of the forest of Lebanon. In other words, that's what they called it. I mean, they sawed down the forest in Lebanon up in Phoenicia, sawed that down, brought it down to Jerusalem, and built a palace. So they just called this the forest of Lebanon. We cut it down and brought it here. 100 cubits long gives you the measurements right there. Verse 6, he made a colonnade 50 cubits long and 30 wide. In front of it was a portico. In front of that was pillars and overhanged roof. So the porticos and the pillars, very detailed, very nicely done. And it gives you details about that and how that was built. We go down to verse 13 now of chapter 7. We go back to the temple. They hired this guy from Tyre or from Phoenicia. His name was Huram. King Solomon sent to Tyre and brought Huram, whose mother was a widow from a tribe of Naphtali. And he's going to build. He was highly skilled in bronze work. And he was given a list of things to build. And it talks about the things that he was going to build. Real quickly, just an interesting fact right here. Here is the temple. Again, here's the most holy place. Out in here, he's going to build these two bronze poles. It talks about them in verse 15. Not poles, pillars. Verse 15, he cast two bronze pillars, each 18 cubits high. That's 27 feet high. So this guy's going to come down, and he's going to have to first cast the molds. I mean, it's not like this is something that they've got a parts department up there in Phoenicia. He's going down there saying, well, what do we want? Well, I want 27-foot pillars made out of bronze. It's like, and that's why they brought Hiram. That's like, whoa. Well, we read on in here, we find out that Hiram's dad was also a bronze worker up in Phoenicia. So he's grown up in the business. And this is probably one of the most magnificent projects he's ever worked on. And so he's going to make these. And on top of those 27-foot high pillars are going to be capitals, or two capitals. Those are the decorative part of here's a pillar. And on top of that is going to be that the decorative part right here. And on that's going to be chains, gold chains are going to be hung on that. And that's going to end up being the bronze capital, it says, is going to be 7.5 feet. So this is 27 feet plus 7.5 feet, just the capital that sits on top of it with the chains. And they're going to be set right here in front. Here's the door coming into it. You're going to walk between these two pillars. And they're going to stand there until the days of Nebuchadnezzar, when Nebuchadnezzar trashes this place. I mean, removes it completely from the tent. It's gone. And all these other parts are going to be brought back to Babylon. They're going to be melted down. Something's going to happen to them. They're not just going to leave them lay, and someone's going to use them somewhere. But if you look over there in verse 21, it says, he erected the pillars at the portico of the temple. That means you come up the stairs under the porch going into the temple. The pillar on the south he named Jachin, and the one on the north he named Boaz. That's just kind of an interesting thing right there. Jachin and Boaz. He named them Jachin and Boaz. And the names have meanings. One, Jachin means he establishes, and Boaz means in him is strength. And there they stand. And so Jachin and Boaz, the two pillars. They're going to be referred to once in a while, but it's just like one of those things, almost like the Urim and the Thummim. It's kind of like, why did they name them? What were they named for? Or maybe they're just representative. Not referred to very much at all. But interesting, notice those were given names. From rim to rim, they were 5 cubits high. Goes on and gives more information about that. As you go through the rest of chapter 7, it's going to talk about the other furnishings in the temple, the little carts. They're going to have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of priests are going to be ministering and working here. So they're going to have more than one, you know, sacrificial knife and more than one little bronze base. And they're going to have multitudes of these things produced. And Solomon's going to have all these done. If you look in verse 41, actually beginning halfway through verse 40, here's a list, a summary of what Hiram built out of bronze for Solomon. So Hiram finished all the work he had undertaken for King Solomon in the temple of the Lord. And here's what he made. This was kind of like, you know, when you get a job, you go out and you bid a job, they give you a sheet, and they want all these things built, and you kind of give them an estimate. Well, this was the spec sheet that he had been given, and he fulfilled. Verse 41, two pillars. And we already know what those pillars are. Two bowl-shaped capitals on top of the pillars. Two sets of network decorating the two bowl-shaped capitals. That'd be the chains. 400 pomegranates for the two sets of network. Verse 43, 10 stands with their 10 basins. And some of you may have little pictures in your Bible if you have like a study Bible. And they found some of these stands that didn't come from Solomon's temple, but from other temples of that time period, like up north in Syria and things. And they look similar to what they have like in my Bible. I got a little picture of them. But they found things like this. Like little carts with wheels that they put the bronze basin. So they're like movable bathtubs for the priests to move around and wash different utensils and wash their hands. They made 10 of those movable stands. Number 4, verse 44, the sea and the 12 bulls on it. Now, we haven't talked about this tonight. But if we were to, I don't want to erase Jachin and Boaz there. There we go. There's a bronze basin right here. Then out here is the altar of burnt offering. So in here, again, here's would be the lampstands over here, and there's several of them. The tables with the bread on them here. The one incense altar. And then the Ark of the Covenant is going to be set back here between the two giant cherubim. Now, this is made out of bronze. This is also made out of bronze. The sea, it's called the sea. But what is on here, it's a huge basin, huge, like a swimming pool almost, in a backyard swimming pool. And it stands on, this is again my artistic visualization of this, there's 12 oxen, 3 facing east, 3 facing west, 3 facing north and south, and there's 12 of them, 3 each on each side, with this bowl, this huge bathtub on their swimming pool on their back, and that is when it says, all it says here, it just says, the sea and the 12 bulls under it. That was something Hiram was bid to do. That would be a very fantastic piece to be able to find that thing, because they had all the details of the bulls. Number 45, the pots, shovels, and sprinkling bowls. These are the things that he built. Verse 48, Solomon also made all the furnishings that were in the Lord's temple. Now, these are going to be the gold work. And now we're not going to read through the whole list right there. But beginning in verse 48, these are other things that he made all out of gold. So that would be, this would fall underneath another bidding, you know, another craftsman was building this golden part right here. And then verse 51, we'll wrap it up with this right here. When all the work King Solomon had done for the temple of the Lord was finished, he brought in the things his father David had dedicated. During David's reign, he collected gold shields or piles of gold or silver or whatever it was, and had begun to store it up and wanted that dedicated to the temple. So once it was done, all of that David, it would have been thousands, millions of dollars worth of things, was brought into the temple for storage, the silver and the gold and the furnishings, and he placed them in the treasuries of the Lord's temple. Now, that's just an interesting thought right here. This is not just a worship center. Again, there's going to be rooms around this. You know, this is the center, but around this there's going to be rooms, treasuries. Jesus, you know, when he was sitting there by the treasury, the widow brought in the two widow's mites and put them in an offering there. This was all part of the collective, the national gold. This was like Fort Knox in a sense. So whenever the raiders would come, if they could get to the temple, not only could they get all the golden objects from the temple for worship, they could rob the national bank. So this was very, very protected. The Levites are eventually, or they are, the guards. The priests were the ones that ministered. The Levites assisted the priests, but the Levites would be guards around this with swords to defend the temple, which was, again, the worship center and the national treasury. Now, verse chapter 8. King Solomon now is going to bring the Ark of the Covenant in. Now, remember, in Jerusalem, down south, down here, south of the Temple Mount, in the city of David, there is a tent, a tent that David has made. It's not the tabernacle. The tabernacle has been destroyed at Shiloh by the Philistines during Saul's or Samuel's day. Then it was moved, the remains of it were moved to Nob, and that was destroyed during Saul's day when he had his Doeg killed the priest. They burnt the city of Nob. Whatever was left of Moses' tabernacle then was moved to Gibeon, which is just right a mile or 2 miles north of Jerusalem. That's where Solomon had his vision, where God asked him what he wanted. And that was the high place of Gibeon. There's some kind of tabernacle there, a high place. But the Ark of the Covenant has not been in any of those places since the days of Samuel's youth, when it was taken to the Philistines and then brought in by David in Jerusalem. And since David brought it to Jerusalem, the Ark of the Covenant has been sitting in a tent. We found out last week, as we talked about people rushing to hold on to the altar so they didn't get killed, there's some kind of an altar made so they could worship God in front of it. There were Levites and priests ministering to it constantly, and apparently Levites were singing almost 24 hours a day, potentially, of worshiping God there at that place where the ark was. It was down here in the city of David. Now, that ark is going to be brought up to the mountain, or the Mount Moriah, the place where Abraham offered Isaac, where the place where the temple has been built. It's going to be brought in and set right here, and that's what we're reading here in chapter 8. Then King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem, chapter 8, verse 1, the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Zion, the city of David. All the men of Israel came together to King Solomon the time of the festival in the month of Ethanim, in the seventh month, and all it goes on talks about this. They're going to bring it in. They're going to be offering sacrifices. It's going to be a big procession. They're going to be using the poles to carry it. And we're going to pick that up right here if you look in verse 8. Verse 7, the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. So the priests are carrying it back in here. Now, I've got it sitting right here. Now, this is just kind of an interesting thing right here. It's a waste of time for a class like this, but it's interesting. There's poles, and these are fairly long poles like this. But when you read this verse right here, in verse 8, the poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from the outside of the holy place, and they are still there today. Notice the phrase right there, they are still there today. Meaning whoever's writing this is also an eyewitness. He's not saying, back in those days, this is what it looked like. He says, that's what it looks like today. Now, eventually, it's going to be changed. It's not like that anymore, because history's come and gone. But also notice those poles. It says the poles could be seen from outside the holy place, or not from outside the most holy place. These poles, if they're sitting like this, they could be seen. And what that means, people are still trying to figure out what that means, because there's some kind of a door, some kind of a curtain way to see this. Does that mean that when they draped, they had to always, whenever they carried the Ark of the Covenant, there's a blanket over it, some kind of a covering over it, but it didn't cover the ends of the poles. So does that mean that the blanket would sit on top of that, and then you could see the poles sticking out? Or does that mean that it doesn't sit like that. It sits like this. And the priest just carried it in like that. And the poles were so long that you could still see the poles sticking out from the inner sanctuary. It's just one of those things that's, whatever. But it is an interesting verse right there because he's saying we can see those poles. And so you got to kind of think about that verse. But that talks about that. Verse 10. When the priest withdrew from the holy place, they're leaving. The cloud filled the temple of the Lord. And that would be the Shekinah glory. That's not like, a fog machine. That's God. That means God's presence. He's manifesting His presence. And this presence is seen several places. You can see it possibly on the Mount of Transfiguration when a cloud came down. And the disciples apparently lose contact because Jesus comes and kind of touches them. And they're like, whoa, what was that just happened? We can see the same thing happening in reverse in Ezekiel chapter 10 and 11 right in there. When the glory of God moves, and this is kind of a sad chapter if we get to Ezekiel, is the glory of God. They could hear the sound, Ezekiel could hear the sound of the rushing of the cherubim, and God had moved to the threshold of the temple. He's leaving. He leaves the temple way before the Babylonian invasion. He's up and out of there. He leaves. And so just like God comes in on this day, Ezekiel records the day the glory of God left the temple, and it wasn't when Nebuchadnezzar came. Nebuchadnezzar came after God had already left. But nonetheless, you can see the cloud filling the temple and the glory of the Lord filled it. Then Solomon makes a statement there about God. In verse 14, 15, he begins to bless the people and tells them how God has chosen them. And that's a great thing. We can study all these. We're going to just breeze through this. Verse 22, Solomon begins a prayer of dedication where he prays a very extensive, long prayer talking about not just God coming, but also talking about this is a place to come for forgiveness. That when the nation failed, they could always come back to this place and restore their relationship with God. That God was going to be here forever as long as the people kept coming and seeking Him. And it's got promises in there. That continues up through chapter, we're in chapter 8, beginning in verse 21 or 22, all the way up until chapter 8, verse 53. And that's where he kind of shuts down this prayer of dedication to the temple. It says in verse 54, when Solomon had finished all these prayers and supplications of the Lord, he rose from before the altar of the Lord where he had been kneeling with his hands spread out towards heaven. He stood and blessed the whole assembly. So now he turns. It gives the impression Solomon is standing or kneeling right in front of this. I'm off the board now. I have to write on the wall here. He's kneeling right here and praying to God. Then he turns back to the people and speaks to the people again. I do want you to hold your place there in 1 Kings and go to 2 Chronicles because this is just worth noticing. 2 Chronicles chapter 7. And realize as we're doing this, 2 Chronicles 7, as we're doing this, we're just going to go through 1 Kings and 2 Kings right now. And we probably maybe refer to 2 Chronicles or 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles is going to tell you the same thing from a different perspective. A couple things about this. 1 Chronicles lines up with 1 and 2 Samuel. It's like the life of David. 2 Chronicles generally lines up with 1 and 2 Kings. A couple things that are different. It would appear, and a lot of people would agree with this, is Samuel, the book of Samuel, would be written from the palace position, the political perspective, the scribes in the palace of the kings writing on what they saw, the political view. Chronicles appears to be written from the priestly side. The scribes of the priests, the Levites, are writing what they see. So they're watching the same events, kind of like the Gospels. Four Gospels recording the same events, drawing out different things. So you're going to see different things from these different two perspectives. But if you look in chapter 7, verse 1, it picks up right where we were at. I just want you to see this. And there's a lot of things to add to this, from Chronicles. Another thing about Chronicles, and we're going to go through 1 Kings or 2 Kings next week, I'm thinking. And we're going to just focus on the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom, or the northern kings of the northern tribes. Because when you get to Chronicles, they're not even mentioned. In other words, from the political perspective, from the palace, they're recording the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel up north and what's going on up there. So they're political, sometimes adversaries, sometimes political foes, but then they consider them part of Israel. From the Chronicles view, once they went up there and started building golden calves and worshiping under Jeroboam's system, never mind. Chronicle, the writers of Chronicles, only give us detail of the kings of Judah. So you're going to get more information on Judah than you are of the northern tribes. Okay, chapter 7, verse 1. We're talking about Solomon finishing praying right here, and he's going to turn and bless the people. But it appears in 2 Chronicles here that when he finished praying, when Solomon finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled it. So you understand right there. I just wanted to see that right there. That God ends up lighting this fire right here when the temple is... He does the same thing. We go back and look at the tabernacle. The same thing happens at the tabernacle in the wilderness. It was all set up. The glory moves in. Fire comes from heaven and lights the altar. So it's just interesting. God's approval is given to the altar in the tabernacle, altar in the temple. Just to stretch this one thing, go back to the Garden of Eden, just mention this. When it talks about Abel's offering was accepted and Cain's was not accepted, it's like this is not a doctrinal statement. It's just kind of just throwing it out there because we've got this pattern of God lighting fires when He's approving of something. I would suggest at least potentially to think about until we prove something different. Because usually in Sunday school classes, you know, Abel's altar right here and the smoke's going up. And then over here on Cain's altar, the smoke goes up, kind of goes vertical. You know, it's like it's or horizontal. It's like there's, God won't let the smoke come up. Okay, that could be it. Maybe God spoke because I like this altar, I don't like this altar. But if God's presence is there in Eden and they've come up to the borders of Eden to worship, fire may have come right out of there and consumed the one that He approved of, would have consumed Abel's offering. But Cain's is like, God's not going to light that. And just ignore. Not a big deal. Fire continues to be important when you get into Ezekiel calling down, or Elijah calling fire out of heaven. The prophets of Baal could not. A sure sign to Israel, we have the God that can bring the fire. Baal does not. He's a false God. Very consistent through the Bible until you get up into the book of Revelation. Paul warns about this. When the man of lawlessness comes, when the Antichrist comes in the tribulation, he's going to be able to perform signs, even signs of calling fire out of heaven. Now, what that would mean, that would be like a reversal of what we saw on Ezekiel or Elijah on the mountain there, where it was clear to the people. This speaks of the confusing days that are coming for the world as we near the end times, where God is going to pull His hands back and says, go ahead, let the false gods bring fire and confuse the people who... And the people who get refused or confused are always those who have rejected the truth already. And God says, since they've rejected the truth, give them a delusion. And they will then, because they've rejected truth, they'll then follow the delusion. So it's important, of course, to embrace truth early on. Nonetheless, that's what we're talking about. Let's go back to 1 Kings. We dedicated the temple. He's spoken to the people. Chapter 9, God appears to Solomon again in 1 Kings chapter 9 and tells him, hey, this is great. He says, my eyes and my heart will always be here. And that, in fact, that is what I was talking to an Orthodox Jew over there at the Temple Mount standing right. Well, it'd be where it'd be over here on this side by the Western Wall. We were talking, and it really kind of gave a perspective here. You know, we think that God's abandoned Jerusalem, and their perspective was like, well, no, we're under discipline, he was saying, to the effect. It says God has not abandoned us. He's taken us through a process, but God's presence is still here. And he quoted verses like this where God says, I will never leave this place. He tells the Jews, you may leave. I may take you to Babylon. I may disperse you around the world, but I will never leave. And in the end, I will bring you back to be here. So what they're saying is they're still confident God's presence is there. Now, again, it's very interesting because you've got the Dome of the Rock sitting here instead. You've got Muslims occupying this right here because Jews gave it back to them. But, you know, just interesting. They use these verses and they consider that. And just kind of interesting. Chapter 9. But anyway, in those verses, God tells him, I'm going to always be here, but you have to walk in my ways. Otherwise, discipline is coming and I will discipline you. And, okay, chapter 9, verse 10. We're through that. At the end of the 20 years during which Solomon built these two buildings, the Temple of the Lord and the Royal Palace, King Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre. Now understand, remember we began talking about Hiram, very excited about Solomon, sending down pine logs and cedar logs, workers going up and Hiram coming down to help build these things for him. Now 20 years has come and gone, all the building projects are done, we're going to refer to them here real quickly. And Solomon says, okay, hey, I owe you something, don't I? Tell you what I'll do. I'll give you, right here, notice right here, King Solomon, verse 11, gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram. Now, the reason he gave them in Galilee, here we go. And you know where Galilee's at. I haven't drawn a map yet here tonight, so this will, if you're confused, this will clarify everything. Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Jerusalem, that's where the temple's at. This is Phoenicia up in here, up in this area here. So Hiram's the king up here. In this part of Jerusalem, and you can find these cities, you can map them out if you wanted to, Solomon says, okay, I tell you what, you can have, I'll extend your borders, you can have these 20 towns. There you go, 20 towns from Israel. Thank you very much. And Hiram was so excited. Here's what he says. Verse 11, King Solomon gave 20 towns in Galilee to Hiram, king of Tyre, because Hiram had supplied him with all the cedar, pine, and gold he wanted. We're talking about 20 years of logs, 20 years of gold being shipped down to Jerusalem from Hiram, because Solomon said, I got it. Put it on my tab. And when it's all said, now here you go. Let me pay my tab. Here's 20 cities in the Galilee. Verse 12, but when Hiram went from Tyre, left the capital of Tyre, to see the towns that Solomon had given him, he was not pleased with them. What kind of towns are these you have given me, my brother? He asked, and he called them the land of Kabul. Now, if you look down there in your footnotes, Kabul means good for nothing. He said, well, I come down here to see these glorious 20 cities you gave me, and this right here is now Phoenicia's land of good for nothing. Solomon, we have a problem. And so that kind of sets the stage here. In just a minute, we're going to get to that and go back to that. So it appears that Solomon can't pay his debt. At least he didn't, not at this time he didn't. Now, it says now, verse 40, now Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. That means during this whole time, he'd shipped down there 4.5 tons of gold with the impression there's going to be some kind of a payment, recompense, some kind of a, we're going to balance our books at the end of 20 years or so. It's kind of like, you know, your nation is in debt to another nation. That's what Solomon, okay, go on. Verse 15, here's the account of the forced labor Solomon conscripted to build the Lord's temple. His own palace. Now, we referred to this last week because I had some pictures I wanted to show you last week, so this is a little bit of a review. He built his palace, the supporting terraces around Jerusalem, the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. And, of course, we looked at the gates. I showed you those last week, the gates of those three cities, and how Pharaoh had given the city of Gezer to Solomon. And in verse 17, and Solomon rebuilt Gezer. He built up Lower Beth Horon. He talks about all these places he built up. Storerooms, store cities, places for his chariots. Verse 20, all the people from the Amorites and Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, these people were the descendants of the Canaanites. They all became slaves during this time period and were into forced labor. Verse 22, but Solomon did not make slaves of any of the Israelites. Talks about what they did. They helped on these projects. Verse 24, after Pharaoh's daughter had come up from the city of David to the palace Solomon built for her, he constructed the supporting terraces. So remember, you know, we talked about Jerusalem. This was David's city, and then the palace was up here, or the temple was up here. She came up and lived up in his palace area too. Three times a year, in verse 25, Solomon would sacrifice offerings. Verse 26 is where I'm trying to get to. King Solomon also built ships at Ezon-Geber, which is near Elath in Edom, on the shore of the Red Sea. So here we go. Extend our map a little bit. Because Solomon says, okay, we need help, folks. He says, we are in debt. Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, Mediterranean Sea. Then down in here is the Red Sea. And then, of course, right here, Mount Sinai, traditional site right here, the Red Sea up like this, kind of got the fingers. This way, Ezon-Geber right here. Solomon goes from Jerusalem down here, and they begin to make ships with guess whose help? Guess who are the great seafaring people of this day? And you know, up north up here, the Phoenicians of Tyre, those are the seafaring people. In fact, there is, you know, another side note here, there is reason to believe that they were in America already at this time. They went out the Mediterranean Sea, went across the Atlantic, came to America for trade, and went back. There's nothing to trade for. I mean, they're out trading everywhere. These guys were the great seafaring people. They were shipbuilders. They grew up on the sea. You don't have to accept my statement about them being over in America, but there's proof of that in other things. We'll go on. But nonetheless, they come down, and they probably had to send an invoice back down and say, Solomon, how are we going to pay for this? Well, you know, we're doing the best we can. But anyway, they came down and helped them build ships, and they're going to sail out of the Red Sea down into Saudi Arabia, down in this area. And you're going to read this right here very quickly. It says, verse 27, and Hiram sent his men, sailors who knew the sea, meaning Solomon, we've got to get this fixed somehow. I'll bring some men down, and we'll help you pay your debt. I'm making that up. I'm not sure. It just appears that's happening here. To serve in the fleet with Solomon's men. Now, again, you don't want Israelites getting on boats and sailing across the sea because they're not seafaring people, but they can help. Verse 28, they sailed to Ophir and brought back 420 talents of gold. That's 16 ton, which they delivered to King Solomon. So now remember, they owed 4.5 ton, and they bring back 16 ton, which is going to really be able to balance those books, but it works so well. If you go on down to verse 11 of chapter 10, we're going to skip the Queen of Sheba part right here. Verse 11 of chapter 10, Hiram's ships brought gold from Ophir. Now that was just their first voyage down and back. They continued. If it worked so well the first time, they're going to keep going down there. And from there they brought great cargoes of alum wood and precious stones. The king used the alum wood to make supports for the temple of the Lord and the royal palace. So much alum wood has never been imported. King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba other things here. Okay, go over to verse 14. The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents, or 25 tons of gold, not including the revenues from merchants and traders from the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. And Arabian, that would be the Arabia Peninsula, Saudi Arabia down this area. There's traders coming through here, and Solomon's cashing in. He discovered a whole new world of trade down here. King Solomon made 200 large shields hammered with gold. Each one would be 7.5 pounds. And he's going to make some smaller gold shields. They're going to weigh 3 3/4 pounds. 200 and 300 of those. Incredible. We skip the part about the Queen of Sheba in verse 10. Queen of Sheba comes from Saudi Arabia down in this area, potentially. That's with the best guess, or southern Arabia down here, which would indicate, why is she coming? Well, Solomon's bringing these ships down. She goes, whose ships are these? Well, it's King Solomon. And she sees all the splendor of the ships. She hears stories of what Solomon's doing up there. So she's got to go up there and find out where all her gold's going from all their exporting stuff out of the country, or at least the area. And she comes up and visits King Solomon. And, of course, she brings with him in verse 10, and she gave the king, chapter 10, verse 10, she gave the king 120 talents of gold. That'd be 4.5 tons. It's just interesting that the amount of gold she gives him is the gold he receives from Sheba, nation of Sheba, is the same amount of gold the nation of Israel owes Phoenicia. You know, maybe it's like, hey, can I borrow something to get this guy off my back? But I don't know. That's just completely speculation. There's no proof of that. It's just kind of a funny part. Never again were there so many spices brought into as those the Queen of Sheba brought. Talks about that. Okay. In other words, things are going real good. And Solomon now apparently was in debt, apparently got a little over-aggressive financially, appears to have recovered, and his splendor is back intact. He goes on in chapter 10, talks about his throne. Interesting verse here. In verse 21 and 22, all King Solomon's goblets were gold, and all the household articles in the palace of the forest of Lebanon, that's his palace, were pure gold. So the temple's dressed in gold, but they got so much gold, everything he touches in this palace is gold. You thought Midas had the golden touch. Solomon's got the golden touch. Now watch this. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's day. Look over in verse 27. Of that same chapter. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones. There was piles of silver. It's like, what's that for? Oh, we're going to do like a little pave the playground with that. What is that, silver? It's like, so in other words, that leads to the joke right there. You know, you've heard the joke about the guy who died and has all the gold bars. And he talks to St. Peter. This is not biblical. Talks to St. Peter. Peter says, okay, you can bring one bag of some, whatever you want to bring, you can bring. You're the only guy who can bring some. So he brings it up, and he gets up this piece. So before you come out, I want to see what you brought. And the guy unzips it. He's got all these bars of gold. Peter says, pavement? You brought pavement? Streets of gold. Okay. I don't have a verse for that. That's because things are going good for Solomon. But in chapter 11, now we begin to decline. Because you realize Solomon wrote the book of Proverbs, which we're not going to really study. You know it's there. It's a great book. It's another whole study itself. The Sayings of Wisdom. Some of it came from Bathsheba. Some of it came from David. Some of it Solomon wrote. But he wrote many other Proverbs that we don't even have. A brilliant mind. That's why Queen of Sheba came up to see him. But Solomon also wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, which begins, vanity, vanity, everything is vanity. And he's to a place where it's like he's lost his balance. He's lost his perspective. He's what I'm going to say. He left the source of reality, the philosophy of God, the philosophy of truth, the revelation that God gave him, and he drifted over here into the area of a false philosophy where the world no longer makes sense. Nothing fits together. It's like having a bunch of pieces but no directions for it. And as he worked with it, and he tried to figure out from this place, he tried to figure out how to make life work, how to make sense of the whole thing. And he, as he says, nothing makes sense. But I mean, there's this, it's very clear on this side, when you look into God's reality, and that's why we're trying to teach the Word of God to our society, to our culture. When you understand the things from God's perspective, things fit together. We've seen it repeated throughout history. The great discoveries of science, you know, the great scientific age came from a time period when people looked at the world from God's viewpoint and began to discover things. But as they drift away from reality back into some kind of false philosophy, we're going to begin to continue to find things that don't make sense. Now, they do if you come over here. And so just remember, the book of Ecclesiastes was also written by the same guy who wrote Proverbs. It just depends on what side he was standing on. It's a sad book, and here we begin, chapter 11. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter. Now, Pharaoh's daughter was probably originally simply a covenant, a peace treaty. But he also married Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites. And again, we're not talking bad about these people, because these people are made up. We've already seen people like Ruth and Jericho, Rahab, people that were from foreign women, from foreign nations who were believers and were welcomed in and became the mothers and the parents of the great men of Israel. So it's not so much that they're foreign women, it's that these foreign women brought with them their foreign gods or their false philosophies. Israel was given the revelation of truth, and so you want to marry people from that revelation of truth. But if you can find a woman from outside of Israel that had the revelation of truth, Rahab or Ruth, bring them in and marry them. It's like Bathsheba, possibly, would be, in fact, Bathsheba for sure, would be completely acceptable. Nonetheless, watch this. Verse 2, they were from nations about which the Lord had told Israel, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. So it's not because you should surely not marry them because they're not Israelites. You shall surely not marry them because of their hearts. Their hearts aren't right. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth. Now again, these numbers are astounding, but just look at the, before you get stumbling all over the 700. Royal birth. These are not just 700 women. These are 700 of royal birth. These are the nobility. These are the most highly trained, the best of the land. Then I think now I think about 700 of them. 700 wives. Goes on. And 300 concubines. The concubines are basically in case you get bored with your wife. It's like, so now he's got 1,000 women. Now, just because we want to spend some time with this, not too much. But if you do the math, if there's 1,000 women and there's 365, well, they say days in the year, but let's say nights in the year. I mean, that's over 2.5 years worth of nights. But nonetheless, it's like, it's like, what kind of world was this? You know, drinking out of golden goblets, but nonetheless, some people say Solomon also wrote the book of Song of Solomon for obvious reasons. But where he is, one of the things he's looking for is he's looking for that right woman. You see? And it's like, he's looking for the love of his life. And he had 1,000 of them, but he's still writing love poetry going, but I can't find her. It's like, obviously because you don't know what it is. But it's just interesting. It's not in numbers, it's in finding the one or making the one. But nonetheless, verse 4, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. Now understand, Solomon may have become king at the age of 18, maybe 20. I mean, he wasn't 30, okay? I mean, just go with 18 for me, all right? Just say 18. We don't know for sure. But we do know he's going to reign for 40 years. He dies at 58, maybe 60, maybe 62, but he's not dying at 70 or 80 or 90 or, you know, 120. He's dying, possibly dying, as young as 58. Which, that's not very old anymore. It used to be old, but the older I get, the younger that looks. But nonetheless, what's that? Right, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's all connected. It's all coming together now. Somewhere in there's a warning. Yeah. But if he's, let's just say 60 to be fair about it, but it could be 58. If he dies at 60, it says in his later years as he grew old. So, I mean, let's say, you know, by the time he was 50 or so. He's starting to go after these foreign gods. I mean, he's already, of all the people in the Old Testament, he's going to have two visitations from him. Not a prophet coming and talking to him, but he's going to have God appear to him in a dream and speak with him. Joseph had dreams in the Old Testament, but they're like symbolic dreams. Solomon's going to have dreams where God comes and appears in him and speaks with him, has a conversation with him. And this man, in his older age, after having built the temple, now I think a lot of us have had experiences with God, if you want to call it a born-again experience or some revelation from God or, you know, whatever experience you've had with God, and you're convinced that there is a God and that you're going to follow God. You struggle in things, but you know there's a God. But imagine being Solomon praying the prayer of dedication of the temple and the glory of God filling the temple, you watching, this is after you prayed, the fire of God lighting the altar, not to mention the visitations he's had in dreams and the things that he's had, the prophecies surrounding. It's like, isn't that amazing? A man like that could then, we're pretty happy if we read through the book of Proverbs. Think if you wrote the book of Proverbs, you think you're doing pretty good. And then at 50 go, and then start drifting, like, I'm looking for something more. I'm looking for something different. It's like, holy smoke, Solomon. I mean, it's like, Solomon, in one sense, is going to be one of the greatest. Jesus is going to use him as an example. No one's going to exceed Solomon in his glory or his wisdom. But as you end up right here, this whole kingdom, if I keep hurrying, this whole kingdom is going to unravel because of these next few years. I mean, the very man that's going to be the pinnacle of it is going to destroy it. Well, here we go. Watch this. Verse 4. As Solomon grew old and his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as his heart David his father had been. Now we know we're not saying he was not perfect like his father David, because we've already read the story of David. David wasn't perfect, but David would keep coming back. He'd make mistakes, he'd keep coming back. He had a heart that went after God. Solomon was with God and just kind of walked away. He followed the Ashtaroth, he followed Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians. Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Look in verse 7. On a hill east of Jerusalem, that would be the Mount of Olives, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh. Now, the high place that was acceptable before the tabernacle or temple was built, because they had no place else to worship, but now the tabernacle or temple is here, that's the focus. But he goes across the Kidron Valley on the Mount of Olives and builds a temple or a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, that he tells God of the Ammonites. So Ashtaroth, Molech, and Chemosh, you can't get much vile than those three gods. Those three gods accepted especially Chemosh, accepted child sacrifices. Now, I'm not saying Solomon was offering child sacrifices, but I am saying in Moab they were. You understand what I'm saying? I'm not going to say Solomon was bringing little babies over there and throwing them in the fire, but I will tell you they were doing that in Moab. So when this foreign wife came over and brought her ideas with her, that was what she saw. In fact, she may have had siblings that had gone up in smoke. That was their culture. And this is now what he, during these last few years of his life, is bringing into Jerusalem. And saying, the guy who builds the temple is now building high places and altars and worshiping foreign gods. Now, understand what's wrong with a foreign god. Real quickly, I don't want to spend much time on this, but foreign gods, the ideal is this. We got truth, which comes from the true God, and that's reality, the right philosophy, the right view of life, how things fit together, includes the revelation of God. And then we're going to have these false gods. And these false gods are not dangerous because they're little gold statues. Okay? I mean, it's not. People do this sometimes. They say, well, you know, we chase after idols too, or false gods too. We chase after money and we chase after pleasure, as if these people didn't. These people also chase after money and chase after pleasure. So that's not really a good definition of what an idol is. You understand what I'm saying? An idol, a good definition of an idol, I am not happy with chasing after money is an idol. Or materialism is an idol. The dangerous part about an idol, the false god, is that they brought some other form, another reality. They brought a false teaching or a false philosophy. They brought a false worldview. Do you understand what I'm saying? Everybody's going to chase after money. Everybody's going to chase after pleasure. Everybody's got a sin nature. What was dangerous about the idols or these false gods was they began to answer questions. Where did we come from? Where are we going? What's right? What's moral? What are our priorities? How do we live our lives? And these false idols then corrupted the culture with falsehood and led them to a place where they could never recover. And this is what is dangerous today. I'm not worried about little golden statues. And again, people chasing after money is going to always happen. What I'm worried about in our culture is this right here, where we have forsaken truth and we are embracing idols. Oh, we're not embracing idols. Well, yeah, people chase after money. Not even that. We are rewriting truth. We are rewriting history. We're rewriting philosophy. We're saying this is the way the world works, and it doesn't. And this can only end in disaster. And that's a very big concern we have today. Well, now you can read the rest of that little bit right there. God speaks to him again. He became angry with Solomon in verse 9 and says there's something going to happen now. In verse 14, God is going to, watch this right here, verse 14. Then the Lord raised up against Solomon an adversary. There's going to be three adversaries. These were all people that were subdued and weren't a problem, but he's going to now raise them. He says, Solomon, this is not right. The first is Hadad the Edomite. Basically, Hadad the Edomite is from Edom, which is down right here, Edom, right in this area. Joab, David's general, had gone down and destroyed these people and subjected them. But in killing all the royalty and the leaders, one of the sons, Hadad, fled over here with some of the advisors of Edom and lived in Egypt, grew up in Egypt. When David died, he was told, hey, David's dead, Solomon's alive. He began to mount his forces and return over here with the support of Pharaoh, who gave him his wife's sister as his wife. So he's married into the royal line of Pharaoh, comes back and begins to bother Solomon from the south. David had already taken care of this, but God let it come back. There's always a root. The next one is verse 23, and God raised up against Solomon another adversary, Rezon, and talks about what he did. And he gathered men around him and became the leader of a band of rebels when David destroyed the forces. This is a guy that David already overrun, but he picked up the remains of it and brought it back. And finally, that's coming from the north. That was from Damascus. So he got it coming from the south, got it coming from the north. If that's not bad enough, right there in his own court is a man named Jeroboam. Jeroboam is in charge of the labor. He's in charge of the building projects. He's one of the chief foremen for Solomon, one of his most trusted men in all these building projects. In verse 26, also Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite. Now, Ephraim, that's from the tribe of Joseph. It'd be one of Joseph's sons. Here's the account of how he rebelled. And you know the story, probably you've heard this before. There's a prophet named Ahijah. And we got to remember Ahijah, he's not done with this story. He's coming back again later. But Ahijah comes up to Jeroboam, one of Solomon's men, and he says to him, he says, the kingdom is going to be given to you. He says, God is going to give David, let David keep one part of his kingdom, one-twelfth of it, one of the tribes, the tribe of Judah. But he says, for you, he says, he's going to give you the rest of them. And again, he ends up tearing his coat and giving him the 12 pieces, and you can read all that right here. And he identifies why. So Jeroboam now has this prophecy hanging over him. Remember how David was anointed king while Saul was still king by Samuel? And that prophecy followed David, and Saul tried to kill David because he was the anointed king going to replace him? Well, this has just happened to Solomon. Solomon is the king, falling into a pattern similar to Saul, and now a man from his own court, one of his top men, has been anointed by God to replace him. And here we go right here. What did Saul try to do to David? Tried to kill him. Verse 40, Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shishak, the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. Okay? Now, real quickly, we no longer say Pharaoh. This is a turning point. Both, this is interesting. And I got to find some place to land this plane tonight. Solomon, it says, in history and in the Bible, the kings of Egypt were called Pharaoh, 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 Pharaoh. Go back to Exodus. Go all the way up to this point. Go back to earlier in the chapter. Pharaoh. Now all of a sudden, both in history and now, a king from his name is Shishak. The pharaohs now have names. They're now recognized in history and biblically. At the same time, they make the switch. And we know about this guy. He comes from a Libyan tribe. He was one of the leading generals of the last pharaoh. And when that pharaoh died, Shishak started a new dynasty. I think it's the 22nd dynasty. Yeah, the 22nd dynasty. It's going to last for 230 years. And when the 22nd dynasty begins historically, they start calling him, not Pharaoh, but start calling him by their names. And the Bible make that same switch right exactly in rhythm with history. Again, that's just an interesting fact about that. Again, attesting to the historical accuracy of the Bible. Well, he never kills Jeroboam in chapter 11, verse 41. As for the other events of Solomon's reign, all he did and the wisdom he displayed, are they not written in the book of the annals of Solomon? It says, Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel for 40 years. Then he rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father, and Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king. And what's going to take place here with Rehoboam, let's go to your books here real quickly. Go to page 113. And we're about done here. In fact, we are done. I'm just kind of laying this down. On page 113, we've got a map of the center of Israel. And you can see right there to the city of Shechem, which is up in the northern 10 tribes. It's up in north of Judah. So Rehoboam is going to go to Shechem, and he's going to meet with the people of Israel who have had, even during David's time, there's a couple civil wars where the northern tribe says, we're not going to follow you, David. We're going to follow our own people. And then they'd all be brought back together. Solomon has held this together. There's been this tension is there. The northern tribes of Israel versus the line of Judah, the royal tribe. And it surfaced a couple times during David's time. It seems to be taken care of during Solomon's time, even though he's making him provide all these provisions for the palace. But that really is the key. Once Solomon dies and Rehoboam, his son, becomes king, they say, okay, just a minute. Before we get into another king from Judah, we want to make some changes. We do not want the heavy burden. We've had to talk about taxation. They say, we have been just pouring things into Jerusalem, pouring things into Judah. Can we do something to resolve this? And he goes up, it says right here, he goes up, Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. And Jeroboam is also going to be in this picture. And you can see Shechem right there on your map. The map right there on page 113, all these cities, we'll mention probably starting next week, Shechem, Samaria, Tirzah, these are all capital cities that are going to be used during this time period. We'll talk about that next week. But basically what takes place in this chapter, and we're going to quit, is Rehoboam says, whoa, I need some advice. So he goes back to Jerusalem. He says, I'll be back in 3 days. I'll give you my answer in 3 days if I'm going to release, you know, have a tax break. And the older men, Solomon's advisor, says this is the thing to do. If you will, at this point, give them a break, they'll follow you the rest of your life. They're just tired of Solomon's heavy hand. He said, I don't know. So he asked the young advisors that he went to junior high and high school with. And they says, now's the time to dig in and let them know who's boss. Not understanding they can just walk away. As they had a misperception. The older men realized the power is where? In the people. And if you get the people to follow you, you can take them wherever you want to go. The younger men thought the power was in Rehoboam because he's the son of Solomon. They says, you're the boss. You tell them what it's going to be like. And you say it's going to be worse now that I'm king, especially if you keep mouthing off like this. He says, yeah, that's a good idea. So he goes up and tells them that. And they say, and you've heard this before, look in verse 16. Have you ever heard this before, earlier in 2 Samuel? They say, what share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your own tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David. And you've heard that before, haven't you? That's when they had the revolt during David's time. They say, what part do we have no part of this. Go back to your own tent, Israel. Will each of you take care of your own tribe? We have no part of Judah. You're fine. You're on your own. And Rehoboam goes, oh, wait a minute. He goes and he gets everybody together. You can see in verse 18, I told you about this guy. King Rehoboam set out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor. He says, if you do this, I'm going to set Adoniram up to you. They say, fine, send him up. And look what they do. But all Israel stoned him to death. Whoa, where'd Rehoboam's power go? Hey, you shouldn't stone my guy. We'll stone you next. In fact, you read this. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. In other words, he found out all of a sudden, oh my, I have no power. The people have the power. So there's lesson number one in politics for Rehoboam. So Israel has been in rebellion against, we're in verse 19, has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. When all the Israelites heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent for him. So he comes back from Egypt, says, hey, I'm back in town. They say, you are king. They make Jeroboam the king of the north up here. Jeroboam is king. And Solomon's son down here, because God had promised, because through Ahijah the prophet, he says, because David was faithful, I'm going to give David one tribe. Rehoboam is going to be king down here. And again, that's going to involve the tribe of Benjamin eventually. And that is that story right there. And in verse 22, they decided, Rehoboam says, well, we're going to go. He hasn't learned, I guess, fully. He said, we're going to go out and we're going to attack Israel and make them become subject to us. And a prophet named Shimei comes out and says, listen, Rehoboam, this is not the thing to do. The reason they rebelled against you is because God told them to. If you fight them, you're fighting the will of God. God has ripped this kingdom apart because of Solomon's wickedness. I advise you not go fight against God's will. So Israel, Judah's soldiers turned around and came home, and they didn't. He stopped the civil war from right there because, again, to Rehoboam's credit, he listened to the prophet. Plus, he'd had two very serious lessons that he's got really no power whatsoever. We pick up next week with the golden calves, and I wanted to talk about this a little bit, but we have a classic example of someone moving in, Jeroboam, moving in, rewriting history, rewriting philosophy and religion, saying, this is now the truth. And Israel never is going to recover from it. You can't rewrite history. You can't make up your own truth. History is history. In fact, history reveals truth and reality. History must be kept straight and pure. Even if it reveals negative things on our part, we've got to teach history accurately and not twist it to our advantage. That's what Jeroboam's going to do, and it's going to lead to their destruction. I'll pray, and then if you have any questions, feel free to ask them. We do have as many books as you want back there, unless we run out of books. We've got more at home. There are some CDs. If you want CDs, help yourself. And we may have some booklets to take and hand out to other people if you want to invite them. We're about full, so we're going to probably have to start looking at another room. So, well, hey, that's, you know, I speak ahead of myself. You may not come back. So, there's always that option. We're down to four people next week. So, but hey, thank you very much for coming. I'll pray, and then you're free to go. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We ask that we may hear and understand these things. We ask that we may apply them to our lives and to our families and to our culture. We ask these things again in Jesus' name. Amen. Are there any questions or anything before we... You're free to go, but if anyone's got a question, help yourself. I don't know. I don't know the exact. It's a measurement. I can tell you here real quickly. Here it is. I'm okay. For example, 666 talents is 25 tons. So I mean that's how I'd have to do a proportion like that. The only reason I know that is I wrote notes in my Bible. I don't know what it's compared to. Okay, so wait, a ton is 2,000 pounds. So here you've got 666 talents for 25 ton. So I don't know, I'd have to get the calculator out. that's a simple question. You could, I mean, that's going to be in a lot of reference books. I just don't know off the top of my head. Right. Yep. That's it. If you go to the back of your book on page 533, you can see I've got a series of maps of the walls of Jerusalem. There's that on page 533. That's that exact same map. Then if you turn to page 534, you can see how the city extended up to include the Temple Mound. And then if you go to page 535, you can see the Jebusite city that David conquered, the Temple Mound, plus the extension that Hezekiah put on going to the west. And then you kind of get a feel for that, how that's kind of changing. It's not very big. Yeah, and it's, yep. And if you go do this for me too, go to that page, go to page 541. And 541, you can see the temple today. That is a modern map today of the old city of Jerusalem. You can see the Dome of the Rock there on the Temple Mound. Then you can see the walls that were built around 1500, 1535. The walls that Solomon the Great built around the holy sites. But notice where the original city of David's at. It's not even the city. Now, where it says Gihon Springs right there, just to the north of it, the Gihon Springs are still there. The water's still flowing. And the four towers that guarded the Gihon Springs, there's four towers there. The bases have been excavated, so you can see those four towers. Just to the north of that, Gihon Springs, is if you go to page 108, again, this is nothing to brag about, but it is pretty cool. Page 108 is a picture of the Jebusite walls that were there and built up. That is just north of the Gihon Springs. So if you're looking at the Kidron Valley, you're looking up out of the Kidron Valley up a huge slope. Then at the top of that begins the Jebusite walls. And that picture there, if we just widen it a little bit, you can see walls built by the Jebusites, walls built by the kings. That's that corner in the back there, and also Nehemiah, walls that Nehemiah added to it. All of them been excavated, and they've got them dated and things. No, but there's nothing left of the city. I mean, it's just been, right. Well, there's people living there. There's houses there. And that's what's so hard about excavating. When you start excavating, you're excavating someone's, you know, under their house. Yeah, and then sometimes then you get the whole Palestinian debate and everything. Yes, ma'am. Oh. It may be because of the relationship. Maybe even when you look at that, again, I don't know. But a wife, a concubine is nothing official. A king is not going to send his daughter over as a concubine. But a king will send from Moab or Ammon or Edom, will send his daughter over to be a royal wife. And of course, then she's going to bring, there'll be a peace treaty involved in that. Just like when Pharaoh had a peace treaty with, when he sent his daughter, it involved the city of Gezer. And that city of Gezer, we talked about last week, was right here, is Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Gezer's right here. It was a trade route to Egypt from the north. It was also a trade route when the Phoenicians brought their logs down, went right through this area here. This had to be conquered and taken control of. The Canaanites were burnt out. The city was destroyed by Pharaoh. And then he gave Solomon his daughter and gave the city to him, with the idea, you will now, and then Solomon rebuilt the city and occupied the city, which now opened the trade routes for Egypt without having to have Canaanite influence there. So what I'm saying is the daughters weren't just given, hey, here's another daughter for you. Here's another daughter for you, and here's the agreement. The daughters always had strings attached. And it may have involved religion, worship. And again, they're not just thinking religion and worship. They're thinking our way of life, where they're thinking philosophy, the way we view the world, is they're bringing that culture into Jerusalem. And you can see it today, you know, peace treaties. You know, we'll sign a peace treaty, but you've got to look at our way of life and consider our view. And sometimes that's good, but sometimes you can start signing treaties that's like, we don't even believe what you're doing. And yet we sign a treaty, now we've got to send our military and defend something we don't even agree with that. And that's kind of a Solomon. I think that's why the wives would have misled him, because they had peace treaties and strings and philosophies attached to them, possibly. A concubine is just, you know, when you run out of wives. I guess. Oh, okay. I have tried to do something a little bit. I've got a website, generationword.com. Generation, if you can spell generation, and then word.com. And then on generationword.com, there's all different little boxes underneath there, you know, if you want to look at videos, if you want to look at maps, different things like this. Go a little bit further down, there's some more boxes, and they'll have, like, say, Genesis. You click on that, that's going to open up a page of all the Genesis teaching, MP3s, video, and some notes. There's going to be Ephesians, there's going to be Romans, 1 Corinthians, Zechariah. I have created one of these down here called Connections. I think it just says Connections on it. I think I just created that last week. It just says Connections. It's real simple now. You click on that box, it takes you to this class with all the MP3s of the classes, the audio. And you can download those if you know what you're doing. You can download those onto an iPod or something like this. There's all the videos of the class, just like this. You click on that. If you got to download Real Player. There's a little box that tells you how to do that. Click that, download Real Player, and just click on the video, and the video will start playing. And you can shut it off when you're done or whenever you're ready. And then there'll be another one called Notes that'll take you to a note page. Because there's another thing that's a little more complicated that's called Bible School. If you click on the Bible School, you'll also find the Connection series, but you're going to find a whole lot more. And it could become confusing because the whole book is online on these note pages. You can also download the book in a PDF form online. But, of course, you got a CD in the back. You got that, too. But generationword.com, look around at that if you want to. And you use. There's like 1,000 messages online, 700 videos or something like that. I used to have a PayPal thing, but it was kind of, if you want to,
The room
doesn't
cost you every night to be here.
Right. And generate, donations are nice, but